I'll give it a try. I'm not a philosopher, and I realize that I'm actually in a meeting of philosophers. It's happening to me more and more often to be invited into meetings of philosophers, and I don't know why. And maybe it's because for the last 25 years, I've basically been studying and looking as an ethnographer, essentially, what people actually do with digital technology in general. So I've been sort of following, you know, the wave from automation to the internet to mobile phones, and now collective intelligence and why. And actually, I have the most oxymoronic title I've ever had. Brace yourself. I am head of collective intelligence at Nesta. It's a brilliant title. I didn't invent it. I'm actually. So let me tell you. So I'm not even going to try and define it. I'm not going to even attempt a definition of collective intelligence. What I just want to mention is the fact that it's becoming a bit of a hype, a bit of a trend. A bit, you know, you're finding this term of collective intelligence, which actually is very often associated with things that really irritate me, which are shoals of fish, bees, and all these sort of movements of insects and animals. But what you're finding is basically you're finding it cropping up more and more. This is just an IBM example. Collective intelligence, capitalize on the crowds. Quora's mission is to share and grow the world's knowledge. It's your best source of knowledge. Ask any question, get real answer from people with first-hand experience. So where is this, why is this term emerging so frequently? And usually it also emerges with this euphemism, which is harnessing collective intelligence, which is actually usually a euphemism for exploiting collective intelligence. So where does it come from and why does it come now? It comes now for a simple reason that after 20 years and about a billion people using internet, there's a sort of widely distribution of digital skills. And I don't mean just the capacity to click or to search or to do stuff like that, but basically to communicate through digital media, to sort of elaborate ideas and read other people's intentions through that, and that this sort of these digital skills have been, you know, are pretty widespread and secondly they're quite accessible. It's actually quite easy to access this content and it's low cost to access it. And thirdly, obviously, that we do have, you know, machines that are smarter in some ways or not, or are doing some computations or not. But the three elements combined actually seems to make people's cognitive work potentially an easily available resource. And I would like to underline this concept of resource, and that's what is behind it. Now, there seem to be three frameworks in which collective intelligence is being talked about most frequently. It emerges in three different sort of frameworks. One is around the ideas of value extraction, the second around the idea of knowledge commons, and the third about citizen participation. So I'll just go through them quickly. So there's the maximum example of collective intelligence and value extraction is obviously Amazon Turk, you know, the infamous idea that you can actually easily divide labor for very low cost and have in very rapid response a solution to some problem or some task. And, you know, obviously, but also in that sort of bunch of discussions around extracting value from collective intelligence, you know, people would tend to put Google search and big data, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of online activities and services that are put there, and also crowdsourcing data, et cetera. So what are the types of issues, and where does it tend to be discussed? It usually is associated in discussions about forms of cognitive capitalism, so digital labor. There's brilliant books on digital labor, value, governance, regulation. So there's a whole lot of research and discussion around collective intelligence that is very quickly in the camp of what is currently being called a sort of form of cognitive capitalism. And there is one argument. On the other edge, completely other side, is what is being called knowledge commons. And it's actually the sort of the mirror image of of Amazon Turk is Wikipedia. Wikipedia is the maximum example, you know, but Linux, OpenStreetMap, all the open source, and now more recently, citizen science, patient communities, etc. So basically platforms for producing and distributing and organizing knowledge in a, with a certain type of governance that allows it. And so there's a quite a considerable literature and debate going around on how do we construct knowledge commons of this sort, you know, which are the formats, why are they actually so difficult to replicate, why is actually Wikipedia so difficult to replicate, etc., and what are the constraints. So, you know, one of my favorite examples is OpenStreetMap. Actually, I'm quite proud it's also Tim Berners-Lee, one favorite example. OpenStreetMap is as you may know, is an open source mapping system in which anybody can sort of anybody that learns the programming and mapping functionalities can actually map areas. I'll come back to this example because it's a brilliant case of it shows some of the biases that are associated with groups of people or collectives actually joining activities together to, in this case, for mapping. You know, other examples, things that I'm working on at NEST have to do more with patients and citizen science and the creation of these. There's a growing number of platforms being created by patients, for instance, in rare and genetic diseases like this one, in which experiential knowledge is sort of mingled with clinical knowledge to create a sort of generally owned environment of information and knowledge, and you know, and in this, so the references behind this type of arguments tend to be, you know, epistemic community. The words that you will hear associated with this will be epistemic communities, communities of practice, obviously creative commons, free software commons, the Ostrom, you know, literature on knowledge commons, etc. So these are the type of words that are associated with collective intelligence and commons in knowledge commons. And the issues that are raised whenever we're talking of this tend to be, and I'm sorry if I'm going quite fast, they tend to be, you know, classic questions about reliability of knowledge, and very classic debates about experiential versus scientific knowledge, clinical versus experiential knowledge, the biases, you know, trust, reliability, etc. You know, very classic questions around scientific science and lay issues. There's a third massive and increasing area in which you'll be hearing about. You can hear about collective intelligence, and that's in the era of citizen participation. In the current crisis of democratic participation or democracies, there is an idea that, again, harnessing the crowdsourced expertise can actually lead public services to mobilize citizens to take better decisions, to increase collaboration, to increase the participation, etc. And alongside that, we also have, you know, the new political movements and digital social movements to improve, to modify, in a certain sense, the forms of democratic participation. And around that, issues around collective deliberation. I think you, I'm sorry, I forgot. Juan gave a perfect example earlier on of collective deliberation when you said that you opened up your first Bill of Rights to collective deliberation. And these are and here we're finding a lot of work going on. There's some a lot of efforts in trying to actually develop software platforms for democracy, like this one, Democracy OS, or later also Liquid Democracy. So what are the tools for, in a certain sense, harnessing and making a wider numbers of digital denizens, you know, participate in various forms of deliberation? So it's interesting to see that you will find in this area very different reflections on, you know, what does, you know, which form of participation we're looking for. Are we looking for deliberation? This is Plaza Podemos, one of the Podemos movement in Spain, and the environments that they're constantly experimenting with, environments in which to enable the largest number of deliberation, and they're constantly contrasting this with the issues of voting and the maximum representativity of the people. Paolo Gerbaudo, who wrote a brilliant book on which is called Tweets on the Streets, just a few days ago, was exactly presenting this tension that these social movements are facing on how to include and which type of tools are best can best harness participation and the difficulties they are facing in the choice between deliberation and actually having, you know, a more single vote plebiscitarian sort of approach. And again, this is a rising wave in a certain sense of activity of thought around collective intelligence. We have in Paris, I know there are experiments on participatory budgeting, as you will find in Reykjavik or Helsinki or etc. United Nations a few years ago started something called the Global Pulse. Again, you see mining citizens' feedback data for enhanced local government. It's always this idea of capturing, etc. We at Nesta, my group, is part of a MacArthur Foundation opening governance network with the Gov Lab at NYU, thinking again about, you know, what are the best ways in a certain sense of, and what are the best cases of engaging citizens in different forms of decision-making processes. Now, liquid democracy, etc. So, I'll just quickly go. Although I'm not a philosopher, I am also a cognitive scientist, and my first degree was in cognitive science. And, you know, I hear collective intelligence. Already I get slightly irritated by the word intelligence, but, okay, I hear collective intelligence, and I hear decision-making, I hear deliberation, et cetera, and I say, well, okay, these are type of questions that, you know, we should be addressing in cognitive science. And so 2 days ago, among other things, I organized an event in which I brought together some of what I think are the best researchers in the field of social movements. Arnaud Monterde, a young researcher from the Ion Cube, the Castells group in Barcelona, who are studying these social movements. Paolo Gerbaudo, as I mentioned before, who is studying new social movements across Europe. And then on the other end of the spectrum, some great names in social cognition, Robin Dunbar, Chris Frith, and other younger researchers like Hugo Mercier, who's doing fantastic work on decision-making and the effect of and how to understand why groups decide better than individuals, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and the problem is that I came out with a slight, and I would like this not to be filmed, but I came out from that, and I said, well, how relevant is cognitive science to these type of new debates? Is it relevant or not? And I want it to be relevant. I really, really want it to. I believe it can be. And actually, I thought I would speak before you, and I thought you would give me the answer. So I'm hoping you'll stay and you'll help me suss this out anyway. Because there is this issue. We have this massive issue. So we've got these systems. We know it's harnessing, you know, skills that are not there. We have certainly new social movements and new things happening. We know a lot about social cognition, and we know, you know, a lot about the mechanism. We know about decision making. And everybody came out, there was no doubt at the end of the day, everybody agreed that collectives make better decisions than individuals. And we can show it at a micro level, we can show it at a macro level, we know it, etc. But what can bring? And so at the end of it, I realized that I had three, you know, there are three big questions for CI. And the first question is it a problem of scaling? And I don't think it is a problem of, you know, scaling cognitive science up to the level of these massive social decisions. So And I think, and that's what maybe the discussion we can have, I think it's more about the problem of the instability of the collectives, and not it's not the size of the collectives, but the instability of the collectives. Then obviously there's a massive question about the form of governance. I'm sure it was evoked probably yesterday. I think maybe Antoinette Rivoire will talk about it tomorrow. You know, how do you govern collectives that are making decisions in this way? And then there's something that is missing, and that that's why I thought it was interesting to come and discuss in this event, is the characteristics of the platforms themselves, in the sense that we are not in nothing of this is independent of the platforms in which it's happening. And here I want to bring back my ethnographer's hat and tell you something about where is all of this happening, actually. Because, you know, we can look at democracy over S, and we can look at liquid democracy. We can look at all the patients for me, patients like me, sites, etc. But the reality is that the majority of all of this that I'm describing is actually happening in Facebook, and it's actually happening in Twitter, and it's actually happening in WhatsApp. So what we're seeing is that the majority of the debates, be it the knowledge exchange between two lupus patients or a group of patients with children with some rare genetic disease, be it social movements that decide on the number of likes, you know, which is the best day to go into a square, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of this is happening in platforms that were not designed for that. And so what are the consequences of this? So let me, skip. I think somebody raised this question earlier on about, you know, again, you know, the design. I think, again, it was in Juan's talk, the design, the politics, etc. And so we're back to, you know, we can analyze these platforms here just from the perspective of the politics and the data and the ownership and the governance. But I think there's another level as well, which is also the cognitive mechanism that these systems are actually enabling. And the fact that each of these platforms are actually enabling a certain type of information process, a certain type of meaning making, et cetera, et cetera. And that is for me the crucial question. I just want to show you this. So the question I had for you. So, which is something that you didn't mention here, in the sense that is if we agree that a lot of what is happening in these collectives is only happening because, in fact, these are distributed systems, and I haven't heard you mention at all the word of extended or distributed systems. You know, what type of distributed cognitive systems are these particular systems supporting? And then it brings back the question is that maybe the real question of building collective intelligence is a circular question of how do we design these systems and what are we putting inside them which are enabling in a certain sense the collective to jointly deliberate or jointly act, etc. So I said I'm going to be short. Where's this chair? You are the chair. So I said I'm going to be short, so I'll leave it here, but I wanted to throw this as a sort of initial provocation. I hope I have made clear that the framing of the debate, because it is so widespread. It's emerging in so many different in so many arenas. It's very difficult, in a certain sense, to make sense of it. It's taken me a few months, to be honest, to say, well, I realize that there's one argument which is really an economic one, and a lot of people are thinking in economic terms. And I think Antonio Casilli probably yesterday, when talking of digital labor, you know, he was definitely talking in that camp. There's a massive and hugely interesting debate around knowledge commons. That's probably where my heart is, to be honest. That's what I want to build, in a certain sense. But then there's in terms of the social implication, probably the debate, the biggest debate is around how do we involve, you know, how are these new systems in a certain sense going to modify the democratic participation, and there is such because that now I am in an organization, I'm not in a university anymore, I'm in an organization which is a think tank and closely linked with policy. We realize that at all levels of government, of local authorities, etc., the idea of involvement of citizens is becoming, you know, through digital formats is really crucial. So understanding what these mechanisms are quite important. So I hope this is clear.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So may I ask you, what do you think about distributed cognition, extended mind, and all that approach?
Distinguish two different questions. One is the question, what are the actual forms of human cooperation and the cognitive significance? And I think the web gives us an enormous power. Mm-hmm. So I can be in communication with philosophers who share my concerns all over the world. Some historian pointed out that he can now get material in one morning on the web that would have taken him 6 months of international travel to different libraries to get. And that is a phenomenal improvement in our cognitive power. Now, when you talk about the extended mind, however, you're talking about, a very mistaken philosophical theory. Mm-hmm. And here's how the theory goes. We now know that functionalism is the right theory of the mind. The mind is just a set of causal mechanisms. But, of course, the causal mechanisms don't stop at our skin. So my notebook and my computer are as much a part of my mind as anything in the brain. That seems to me hopelessly mistaken. I could go into great detail why it's mistaken. So I distinguish between the actual practical use of human cognition in social contexts where the sociality of the context increases the power of the cognition enormously. I distinguish that from false theories that say the mind is everywhere. I don't think the mind is everywhere. I think human and animal brains are special. Mm-hmm.
A question concerned the very idea of, collective intelligence. The hypothesis that collectivity usually chose better than individuals, is it true? Because I can, this is not an optical effect that depends on the fact that collectivities decide slowly, and the slowest decision is usually better than faster decision. An individual usually decide rapidly, and the possibility of being wrong. I mean,
I find the best argument for this is Dan Sperber's and Ugo Merz's set of papers on, you know, the argumentative theory of reasoning and why, you know, and they really explain, you know, in a certain sense, why the typical reasoning biases we fall into, you know, the classical, you know, confirmation biases, etc., why these, in a certain sense, they puzzle about, you know, why do we have them? What, it doesn't make sense that we make these mistakes, you know, so systematically. And so their argument is actually that we have these biases because, in fact, reasoning serves the argumentative purpose. And then they show how, in a certain sense, in argumentation, you know, there is a progressive approximation towards the right answer. So I'm not very good at giving you that, but I would really recommend the reading of that approach. But I do agree. I mean, there is also the hypothesis that there's a folly of the crowd, not just the wisdom of the crowd, and that there are biases, etc. I mean, those
maybe are two different, because if you imagine, in fact, Hitler was democratically elected by Germans, by the majority of Germans. Seemingly, there was a minority of Germans who had a better idea, made a better decision than the other. Yeah. But maybe there is a difference between the bias of collectivity and maybe one can say that an election, in fact, is a sum of individual decision. single individuals voting and the result, and the other is me, you, and Professor Searle deciding where to go. The dinner maybe is more reflected.
But that is exactly when I, you know, when I provocatively, you know, put my question about the relevance of cognitive science. It's exactly the point, in the sense that what you see here, but it is the same issue, the issue of scalability. You know, a lot of the cases and examples that we discussed the other day, you know, were based on dyads or, you know, small groups, reasoning on a very controlled, etc. So we have, the, you know, the classical issue of scaling across these disciplines. Having said that, I don't have a particularly strong stance on collective intelligence. Not because I have this title that I think, you know, that this is, you know, I don't particularly think it's a good term, to be honest. I think, you know, we do have a lot of research on social cognition, and we, you know, we have, you know, I think there is a number of elements that show us there is a predisposition towards the capacity to have joint intentions and joint attention, etc. So, I mean, that this is something that we know. We know that we are capable of thinking together, and we can even one of the papers that I wrote with Mattia Gallotti on the idea of he brought to the table this idea of we intentionality. Can we think in terms of we, etc., etc.? I think there's what I wanted to bring on the table here is that I think today is that there is something that is clearly happening, in the sense that there, with the widespread access of to these skills, there is clearly a movement towards saying, well, how can we use it? And the metaphor that is being used is one of collective intelligence. I think it deserves, you know, a really close scrutiny, and not just from economists and not just from political scientists. You know, I think it does deserve a scrutiny from cognitive science and philosophy as well, because it does raise some new questions. I don't necessarily know what, you know, what the right questions are, but I do realize that there's a phenomenon that is worth analyzing, and which I think is the most interesting phenomenon on the web at the moment, because exactly it is actually triggering probably the most powerful set of new practices. You know, because that's why I said I've been following. What the most interesting things that are happening at the moment are these phenomena of, okay, you know, we create a platform to suddenly share our data around something to enable the solution of whatever. That can be, you know, how to plant your tomatoes, to how to solve a genetic disease that your child has. So this capacity these skills are coming together, and they are being mobilized. For instance, Paolo Gerbado, who is making a really interesting point. He's writing a new book on which he called Populism 2.0, in which, you know, he tries to challenge the idea that, you know, what is a techno democracy, this idea that we're all equal on that, you know, there's this new form of mass, which is the lanternaute. You know, lanternaute is the new what in the past was called the new, you know, people, new masses, etc. What are the consequences of that in terms of?
I have a question myself. We have also old forms of common knowledge and common deliberation. So I wonder, I ask you for a sort of short comparison, in the sense, I wonder whether it's just the web is just a way of making more powerful our old forms of collective knowledge and collective deliberation, or it also involves new forms of collective knowledge. It's just a quantitative improvement, or there is something more?
I don't know. I mean, the anthropologist in me, my sort of half, you know, would tend to say that in the past we probably would have talked about culture. You know, we would have called this as, you know, a normal process of, you know, of cultural development and the creation. So I, you know, in Again, if I take my anthropological hat, I would say no, I don't think there's such a big difference. The only thing that is changing is the speed, and you yourself were talking about speed and time, and I think, you know, the only thing is, however, the other side of me also think, well, what is however new is the fact that while in the past, whatever forms, you know, we did tend to have, you know, a greater cohesion and a greater social cohesions of the groups participating in this process of construction of new concepts, etc. But and while here it's much more dispersed, which brings me back to my the word I had before, which was the instability and not the problem of the scale, but this instability. Arnau Monterde the other day, who's studying these networks, I hope I can find him. Yeah, these networks, they do the analysis of the Twitter and Facebook networks of the 15 de Mayo movements, which became Podemos, etc. And what emerges extremely clearly, which is really interesting, is a constant aggregation and disaggregation. He actually said something interesting. He said, you cannot think of these social movements in the old political terms of I am having a set of values. I am not, you know, they're not communist because I believe this and that. I am not liberal because I believe that. No, I am 15M because I go to the square, because I want this action, because I want to stop evictions, etc. It is much more actionable and essential. And so what you see, the thing on the right is the different parties before the elections. But what you see is that when you look at it over time, is these, you know, these aggregation, disaggregation, which is very typical of any form of online collective, be it, you know, people contributing to OpenStreetMap. You know, people go on, they do it twice, and they stop, then maybe something happens, there's a tragedy in Nepal, and there's a call for mapping Nepal, so people go all back on, and then they're off, etc. So I think that the novelty and what we have to explain as social, cognitive, or whatever scientist is, you know, is this instability. How is it, while in the past we had so many other mechanisms that bounded, you know, social mechanism obligations, like Sarah was saying, and you know, that bounded us together and that made us in a certain sense participate in the reasoning process, in the elaboration of things. Well, now it's not just the distance, but it's instability. You see, so for me that is, I feel that the unstable feature of it is what we have to, is the most complex problem we have to deal with.
I think we are forgetting to mention emotion. Mm-hmm. Emotion is the binding element here, mm-hmm. the 15M,
yes.
I think. So we cannot think only of cognition. Emotion is a big part of cognition, and this the binding element there was being very angry.
Yeah.
Against
yes.
the situation, the crisis, the situation in Spain. So it's not a rational thing. If you don't talk about emotions in these situations, we're not understanding how people are being mobilized.
The paper I stole this image from, which is published by the group at the Open University of Catalonia working on this. One of their biggest articles actually was an article exactly on emotions, on identity and emotions, and, you know, and what is, you know, what are the main triggers of actually these assemblages and so on. So I couldn't agree more. I mean, you cannot understand anyway the political movements without that, which is exactly the same emotions that also drive, you know, groups of patients getting together and building something and finding doctors and building, you know, and finding information, etc., etc. You know, if I look at, you know, this is the Facebook page of a lupus group, you know, there's a combination of emotions, of science, of this all coming together. But so I totally agree.
Can you please switch to the last
Which
last slide? Yeah. because my question is very general about the Nesta project. So is it correct to say you are a sort of network of people coming from different backgrounds, trying to define a sort of black box, which is the because I read the question of what is the web is therefore crucial, and then the question is really about the design. So are you designers of something you
I'll tell you
the second question is, do you need philosophers to in order to do what you want to do?
I mean Nesta is something that doesn't, I think it's to explain what Nesta is, one has to understand the role of charities in the UK. So I think Nesta was born as the National Endowment for Science, Technology and the Arts about 15, 20 years ago, and was part, was what was called a Quango, a quasi-government organization, with a mission to do research on innovation and support innovation. So currently what it does, it has a a few years ago, a lot of the Quangos were pushed out to be sort of more autonomous. Nesta was pushed out with quite a large endowment. And it contains a department of research and policy, about 50 people working on very disparate topics that can be from the creative economy to development to how to support startups, etc. And then a part working on basically supporting social innovation in the UK. So initiatives on the renewal of the NHS, how to support local groups, etc. So collective intelligence is just a time. I mean, we're three people, and Jeff Malgan, the CEO, who's very interested in this. But there's also a project going on. So, and we're trying to work out where, you know, what are the interesting areas. One of the areas that we're interested in is patient organizations, because we feel that there's a dramatic lack of tools. So we try to, in a certain sense, counter this e-health movement, which is very individualistic. And we're trying to say, well, actually, these groups have a lot of knowledge, but they have it's very difficult for them to put it somewhere. But there's an ongoing project of which Nesta is part, which is called Descent. My colleague Francesca Bria is with a lot of, actually some universities, Sorbonne, a lot of universities, it's an EU project, which are working on different aspects, more in the first category of value, of participation. So they're working with Podemos, with liquid democracy tools to see how these can be improved, etc. So the short answer, and also it is a type of organization that always works in partnership. So we are in partnership with the MacArthur Foundation. We're in partnership with the Human Mind Project in London. That's why I asked a philosopher to help think about it. So it's a very fluid, in a sense, it's a very collective intelligence type of organization, because it's a very network organization. And that's, so there isn't an agenda behind it. It's just, we're trying to understand, we know that something is going on, and we're trying to understand, you know, what it is and how it can be, in a certain sense, leveraged for, you know, to support some different type of activities.
In the meantime, you're aware, you need a definition of what the web is, like Enrico hypothesis this morning, or are you just an operational group working?
I don't know. You know, everything. I look around in all my website. You know, when I'm sitting in a big room, everybody has PhDs in something, so we're all researchers in a way, but we're also policy. Support and trying to provide. So I think yes, in a sense, it is an operation. In the sense that we are trying But I'll give you the link to some of our documents. I mean, some are really 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 theoretical, and some are, you know, quite. But what I wanted to bring here is simply the awareness that this is, you know, this the debate that I'm sure you are perfectly aware of, you know, that this is a term that is going around a lot, and, you know, what can we see behind it, and what are some of the questions that I think are relevant. I mean, as I say, I think Hidalgo decided to give 10% of the budget to shared, you know, budgeting. That's an example. But how is this done? You know, what are the problems, we know there are problems to do that, etc.
Thank you.
Thanks.